The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Tuesday, and we each step into another evening and another day tomorrow, hopefully. The big story of the day, and it continues to be so blatantly obvious what the so-called West, it's not us, so-called West is doing, and they're trying to force Vladimir Putin and Russia into a nuclear war. They announced today, and most of you, I'm sure, saw it, we've got it up there, and that the UK is sending tanks, some of their Challenger 2 tanks, to Ukraine, and they're going to send depleted uranium rounds for the tanks and other weapons. In other words, their artillery rounds are going, the tank rounds are going. DU. Russia has said, and Putin has made it very clear, I think Lavrov did too, that if they begin to shoot depleted uranium, which are nuclear weapons, even in a passive sense, if they begin to use them over there, that Russia will consider those the use of dirty nukes, and they will respond in kind with tactical nukes. So another red line has been approached and verbally has been crossed, and we'll see. They're going to fly them in there, and they begin to be used against Russian tanks. And for those of you who don't know, depleted uranium will go through virtually any metal, any steel, armored personnel, carriers, tanks, it doesn't matter. The DU rounds go right through it. They are so volatile. When they come out of the muzzle of either a tank cannon or an artillery tube, they're actually a fire. They're burning. And when they hit the metal, they sort of burn their way through it in a microsecond. And then they explode, scattering uncountable numbers of radioactive particles, which happened to Iraq. And, of course, Iraq is still radioactive right now. How many people have been killed from that? Uncountable numbers, they say. So at any rate, we're constantly upgrading the war threat. All right, let's get off that subject. I just wanted to make sure you all heard it. Ancient high technology, the astonishing scientific achievements of early civilizations. One of the biggest mysteries of all is how did they do certain things? I ran a story about the temple at Baalbek, and those enormous quarried stones, what, 800 tons or something? And come on. First of all, how do they cut them? Not with Bronze Age chisels and mallets. And secondly, how do they move them? Not with mules, not with slaves, not a chance, not even on the table. So something going on back there. And the man I'd go to, and he's here with us now, to find out what we do know about ancient high tech is Frank Joseph. Hello, Frank. Good to have
Hello,
you back,
Jeff.
As always.
Thank you for
we always
me back.
Learn.
It's great
You're
to be
welcome.
Here.
We always learn wonderful things. We know so little about this planet and our past. It's all been sequestered away from us, hidden, kept from us. I mean, it's not like we have a birthright to know. They don't care. They hide it. Anyway, so tell us more.
Well, when we think about the ancient world, most people imagine that the greatest achievement of the ancient world was the Great Pyramid of Egypt. And it certainly is one of the greatest human achievements ever. But there are accomplishments from the ancient world which are larger and more complex and certainly a rival to the Great Pyramid and almost completely unknown outside of where they've been found. And it's interesting that when I was preparing this presentation today, I saw on the news this morning that a new site has been found precisely on the thing I was going to talk about, and that is the underground cities. We're talking about cities, a network of cities that covered hundreds of square miles. They still exist. You can still see them. And while I was preparing this, lo and behold, this new find was announced just this morning. Archaeologists have discovered a cave. Now, not many of these caves are found. There are very few that still exist out of who knows how many that were in existence originally. This cave is covered with magnificent drawings and representations and paintings. It's found in northeastern Spain outside of Barcelona. And it's in an oval-shaped cavern about 1,000 square feet in size. And when archaeologists found it later last year, they only just announced it this morning, as I say, they found a mural inside, 26 feet long. And the mural is similar to those that are more familiar to our listeners, those that are found in France and other parts of Spain. Not quite as magnificent as some of the paintings at Lascaux or Trafraera, but still very terrific. And the mural that they found in Spain, it indicates, it has representations of horses or cattle and some human beings, and they seem in a juxtaposed position to depictions of the night sky. There are also prominent stars that are featured for reasons not properly understood. But one of the things that appears to jump out from this site is that there are representations in this cave which goes back a good 5,000 years. In other words, somebody was painting in this cave just about the time or a little before ancient Egypt got started in the Nile Valley, quite a distance away. But what's interesting about the cave is that it shows what could be, might be, representations of constellations that are still familiar to us today. So it's kind of an amazing thing that 5,000 years ago, people were in possession of some kind of a conception of the sky and the constellations with some of the same ones that we are associated with today. That still is to be proved, but it seems to be indicated by that.
A question.
And although the mural, these caves are well known, what is not well known and goes back
Frank,
to the
may
same
ask a question.
Period,
hold on. A question.
Yes, go ahead.
Can you hear me? Yeah.
Yes, I can.
A question about the mural. This is very interesting. And what is the approximate time frame of the mural?
The mural is about a little older than 5,000 years ago.
Okay. Well, my question is nullified then. I was going to ask you, how do they equate to Roman murals and frescoes and things like that? But these are obviously
not at all. They're really far removed by that. Rome didn't get going for thousands of years after that, of course.
Very good.
And the mural, apparently, like I say, it has to do with some kind of astronomical or astrological points of view that people had then.
Okay.
And this is right at the very end of this cave painting phase. The cave painting began, if you can imagine such a thing, more than 34,000 years ago in Indonesia. It's a little island in Indonesia called Sulawesi, and it has the oldest known rock art in the world. And it's magnificent rock art. It has got to be not the oldest, just the oldest that's known. So we're 34,000 years ago, and some of the rock art there represents dolphins, beautifully painted in red. Magnificent work. So civilization reached really pretty high levels long before human beings ever conceived of the beginning of organized society. When you and I went to school, our teachers said, well, society began in Mesopotamia, about 4,500 years ago. Well, I think that's a very late date for it. But what most people do not know, and this is a terrific achievement that this Austrian university professor found, a discovery actually with his wife, Ingrid. The fellow I'm talking about, his name is Heinrich Kusch. He's an Austrian professor of prehistory. So he's a university-trained archaeologist. He's not somebody on the fringe in a tinfoil hat. And 40 years ago, he was investigating what is kind of pretty well known. There are these caves or like cellars. They're not very deep, and they go back to the Middle Ages. They go back to about 1200, 1100 AD, something like that, about 800 to 1,000 years ago. And they were monastic cellars where Christians would do their meditations and prayers. They're kind of like underground chapels of one kind or another. And he saw at the end of this one medieval chapel, definitely medieval chapel, it's about maybe 10 feet under the ground. I guess this chamber was maybe 10 by 10 feet, something like that. But at the end of it, he saw what appeared to be a very old wall. And the church authorities allowed him to go through that wall. He said he wanted to go through it to see if there was an extension of this monastic chamber. And when he tore down the wall, he was shocked to see that it was the opening to a tunnel that was completely unlike the monastic chapel. And he thought, well, is this a lava tube or something, some kind of a natural formation? But no, he was able to determine there were tool marks on all over the walls of this tunnel. And the tunnel was kind of narrow. It was about maybe 2.5 feet wide. It was maybe not quite 6 feet tall. And he followed it with his wife, Ingrid, and it turned out, to make a long story short, that this tunnel went on for hundreds and then thousands of feet, and it would widen sometimes to as much as 5 or 6 feet and get as tall as maybe 7 feet, not quite 8 feet tall. And there were niches inside. There were benches carved into the rock. He was able to find a stone cup. And that was very important because the stone cup was easily identified as belonging to the late New Stone Age. In other words, somebody had carved this tunnel, this magnificent work of subterranean art, about 12,000 years ago. So he pursued this tunnel and found others like it. Some were connected, others were disconnected. And over the course of the last 50 years now, he and Ingrid have found these underground tunnels spreading all the way from Austria, where he lives, all the way up to as far north as northern Scotland, towards the Orkneys, and all the way as far south as northern Italy on the Mediterranean. And in Austria alone, he was able to find the longest continuous tunnel, which is 1,150 feet long. He also found that these tunnels, they corresponded to megalithic sites. In other words, Stone Age, standing stones, temples, something like Stonehenge, maybe not that quite ornate. And these structures, of course, are found all over Western Europe. And these tunnels, you would go from one site into this tunnel, and you follow through the tunnel, and it would rise up and exit into another megalithic site. They don't all do that, but some of them do. And so he's been looking at studying this for quite a long time, and he was able to determine that there is a network of these tunnels that are under the ground. They're about maybe 50 to 100 feet below the surface of the earth, and they were carved, like I say, mostly between 12,000 and 5,000 years ago.
The technology
necessary for that is completely outstrips our understanding of anything in the Stone Age.
Did they look like they were hand-hewn?
They are. They definitely are hand-hewn. There are tool marks all over these tunnels, these corridors. Mm-hmm. And there are also adjacent chambers and rooms, not particularly large, but nonetheless it was used for something, and they've been cleaned out. There's not a sign. The only thing found was that stone cup, which was very important to identify this as a new Stone Age, a Neolithic site. So it's quite an amazing achievement to think that people have been walking over Western Europe for all these many centuries and have completely been unaware that beneath their feet are this intricate network of tunnels.
What would have been potentially the impetus for building these underground cities connected by these long tunnels?
Well, these are not cities.
Go ahead.
These are just the tunnels. There's some speculation what they were used for. Perhaps they were used to go from one site to another as part of some kind of a ritual, a ceremonial, or they were used to travel through areas in which there were, at that time in the New Stone Age, very dangerous animals, large and dangerous animals, the saber-toothed tiger.
I get it.
Mastodons and so forth. So maybe it was used to avoid them. Who knows? But it raises a lot of very difficult questions. Number one is, how do the people breathe in these tunnels? How do you breathe in a tunnel if you've got more? Let's say you've got a small crowd of people and you're in a tunnel more than 1,100 feet long. There's absolutely no indication of any kind of air shafts, nothing like that whatsoever. Also, how do you work in pitch darkness? There's no indication of there were any torches. There's no sign of burning anywhere.
Well, even in the Great Pyramid, they had air shafts, did they not?
They had air shafts in the pyramid. That's right. They do have air shafts in the pyramid. If you take a cross-section of the Great Pyramid, you can see that there are provisions for people going inside, places to walk, places to breathe. Absolutely, and places where you can even use briefly torches and so forth. Right. I think they maybe have even found scorch marks on parts of the interior of the Great Pyramid, although that's very controversial. But nonetheless, that's a possibility. But not so with these tunnels that crisscross all over Austria, Bavaria, Middle Germany, up through the Scandinavian countries and across the North Sea into Scotland. Incredible. Of course, Scotland is... features a great number of very important megalithic sites, like the Orkneys and Scarabray and places like that. All those seem to be connected somehow by these underground tunnels. But these tunnels, as magnificent as they are, as mysterious as they are, they absolutely pale before this immense achievement in Turkey. As I said, virtually no one knows about this. Certainly... it's not taught in the schools or featured on the evening news. There's a place called Derinkuyu, and it's a small town. It's about 400 miles southeast of Ankara in Turkey. And in 1963, there was a man who was working in a cellar in his house just outside of Derinkuyu. And he was expanding his cellar when all of a sudden the wall collapsed and another room stood in front of him, obviously a hewed-out room. Pretty sizable room, more than a chamber. So he immediately notified the authorities, and the archaeologists showed up, and they found that there was this magnificently carved room, which led off by a series of corridors to another room, and another. And over the course of the days, months, and years that followed, at Derinkuyu, the archaeologists were able to unearth or dig into a full-sized city, an absolute city that extended something like 200 feet below the surface of the earth, carved into the volcanic rock, and had all of the details of a metropolis, a sunken metropolis. And this
can you give me a name to look this up?
A number of cities that were found throughout Turkey. But Derinkuyu is the one that has been studied the most thoroughly and the longest. And
how do we spell that?
Okay, Derinkuyu, and you can look this up. Let's see if I can find a spelling. It's a D-E-R-I-N.
Oh, hold on. D-E-R?
D-E-R-I-N. K-U-Y-U, Derinkuyu. And what they found was a series upon series of private domiciles, regular apartments with separate living quarters that included bathrooms with flush toilets.
I've seen this. It's phenomenal.
There were niches cut into the walls, presumably for storage, but who knows, perhaps for the display of ancestral or religious objects, who knows, possibly statues. There was a network of high, broad passageways connecting shops, wineries, because they found debris, organic debris, chapels, communal or conference chambers, hospitals, libraries, workspaces, oil presses, animal stables, cellars, schools, bakeries, immense food bins, granaries, restaurants, administrative centers, rubbish containment areas, arsenals for weapons, barracks and tombs, all this underground by a people that had no idea who could have possibly done this. There were wells that provided fresh flowing water. They were built over aquifers, so whoever built these cities knew exactly where the water was before they even built the cities. So you had plenty of wells that provided fresh flowing water throughout the complex. That made the flush toilets work. The places
flush
were efficiently air-conditioned.
They had everything but big screen TVs. Okay.
Well,
and movie
that's why we call them civilized, I guess. They had air conditioning. This was by regularly sunk ventilation shafts. 52 of them have been located so far.
For our listeners, Frank, if you look up Darin Kuyu, that's DERINKUYU. DERINKUYU. There are cross sections shown in some of the images of the underground excavations and what Frank is describing. And this is absolutely phenomenal.
It is. Yeah. It is phenomenal. The site's largest feature during Kuyu is a room, a very spacious room, with a superbly carved barrel-vaulted ceiling on the second floor. And it was speculated, the archaeologists speculated, it was used for as a religious school or a meeting room of some kind. There is a vertical staircase from the third to the fourth levels, a massive staircase for a dozen people to use at one time, more than that. It connects the corridor descending to the next lowest level.
I see the vertical air shafts, too. I can see the ventilation.
This city alone, Darin Kuyu, if you can imagine such a thing, it's difficult to imagine, it's 18 stories down into the ground. 18 stories. And it goes down 280 feet beneath the surface of Turkey. It's connected by massive steps and stairways regularly cut into the rock. Each floor was sealed off from the rest of the site by these strange doors. They were like rolling stones. They were great discs of stone. Sometimes they weighed about a ton, and that they were so perfectly balanced that people could easily roll them back and forth, and they could lock. And some of these stones, they were as much as 1 foot to 20 inches thick. And they weighed between 440 and 1,100 pounds. But they were beautifully balanced, as I say, and so it was easy to roll them back and forth. There was also a kind of a peephole associated with them. Now, this city of Darin Kuyu had around 50,000 residents, 50,000 people living in this city. And it's just as one of the single greatest achievements of the ancient world. But that still is nothing, because when archaeologists continued their work, they found a tunnel that ran north in a straight line for more than 3 miles to another underground city. And this one is even bigger. It's called Kaimakli. And Kaimakli is built in the same way, and the same kind of rolling doors that they have with granite. Except that this one has the biggest of all of the doors. It's made out of solid granite. It's nearly 6 feet across and weighs several tons. But again, can be opened and closed by one or two men, probably. Now, when you get these, they found eventually five other cities, or excuse me, three other cities. They found five of these cities connected all together in Turkey. And their combined residency was 100,000 people. All of the evidence shows that these people lived in these same places at the same time. These residences were not built over the course of many thousands of years. They're relatively easy to work in because it's a volcanic tufa. And tufa you can dig into rapidly and quickly, and it holds together really well. One of the most amazing cities they found, the biggest city they found, is a place called Özkonak. I can spell that for you. O-Z-K-O-N-A-K. And that's the largest of them all. And that had over 60,000 people living there. Now, since these since these structures were found, well, Özkonak, that's one thing about them that makes Özkonak so big. It's only 130 feet down only, compared to 200-some feet down to the others. But all what's interesting about Özkonak is that all of its 10 levels are connected by speaking tubes, a network of speaking tubes. So you can speak in a normal tone of voice from the top level all the way down to the 18th level. 10th level, I'm sorry. They're
oh,
the level.
That's amazing.
It is.
It's just mind-boggling. The question immediately comes to mind, what prompted these people to go subterranean?
That's one of the big things. And before I get on to that, just one final thing about these cities. They're all made about the same. Mm-hmm. Some of them vary a little bit in that the architects, the builders, use different colored stones. Obviously, in some kind of an aesthetic effect, they used white pumice, black lava, and red tufa in bands. So they had an aesthetic sense. Since these cities have been found, and they're still finding them, by the way, they have not found all of them, but they found a lot of them since 1963, the total number of people who were living underground was 3 million. 3 million people living underground.
That sounds preposterous. Where did the toilets
preposterous.
Frank, where did the toilets flush to?
They had...
the water. Where did
so
the water run to?
They were able to dispose of. They were able to dispose of that. There are the same drains that were used by humans. They had another, a larger drainage system that was used by their animals. They kept animals underground.
Wow.
So
I see the rolling stones for the doors. That's quite remarkable, too.
They are. They're quite remarkable.
Yeah.
The question, of course, is a number of questions arise. When were these things made? When they were first found, it was assumed that these, again, were like the tunnels in Austria, that they were used by early Christians to escape persecution. And there's no doubt that that did happen, that the Christians knew about these sites and inhabited the sometimes the top floors, rarely going deeper than the first or second story down, because archaeological evidence has shown what looks like Christian chapels, Christian symbolism, and so forth. However, the deeper you go, when you go below the second story, then all signs of Christian habitation cease for the most part. So it would appear that this is something that was made long before the Christians were there. Also, it's not understood if these works were entirely excavated by the Christians, where was the population large enough to be involved in their excavation and their work? There wasn't any, as far as is known. The population of Turkey plummeted after the collapse of the ancient world, especially after the end of the last... or at the end of the late Bronze Age, population of Turkey became very small. Also, how do you provide for lighting? Again, just like the tunnels in Western Europe, how do you provide illumination? Sure, there is ventilation down there that worked, but would that really work for 3 million people?
Not by our standards of measurement. No. They had to have something else.
And the animals living down there?
No.
No. No. But the lighting, that is a very large problem because there is no indication below the second levels that there was any torches being used. Not only that, but a number of these cities were not occupied by Christians. As a matter of fact, most of them were not. Derinkuyu was. Mm-hmm. Kalmaki was. Because you can find, as I say, indications of Christian worship going on there. And you can find indication on the ceiling of people who were using torches to light the way. But you find nothing like that. No torches, no indication of any kind of lighting going on when you get below that second story and
mystery.
You go down as far as 18 stories. Yeah. Nothing like that at all. How did they
you
see?
Think of these,
the other question...
Well,
go ahead. Go ahead.
No,
well,
no,
the other question, of course, is who did this? Who could possibly have made it?
Well, they had to remove, remember, they had to remove all the mass of the volume of rock that they took out to make these underground cities. So where did, how did they take it out? How did they lift it out of there?
How did they take it out? How did they take it out? Exactly. That material is relatively easy to work with. I say it's volcanic, but nonetheless, when you're excavating whole cities that can accommodate up to 3 million residents, how is that possible?
Doesn't make sense. They had something else. What does your instinct tell you about lighting? They had to have something else.
It's more than instinct. Because it's just common sense. You cannot, if people, in other words, if they had used oil lamps and they had used torches, they would have all suffocated in no time whatsoever.
Would have eaten
and also,
up the
of course,
oxygen.
They would have eaten up the oxygen. And with the animals down there, it wouldn't have lasted at all. Any people that are brilliant enough to design and build something like this would not have been foolish enough to have used burning materials to light the way.
No.
The other question is, so how old really was this? Well, there is, the first real reference to these sites is a Greek traveler. His name was Xenophon. He was also a philosopher, and he writes about them. He belonged to a battalion of Greek soldiers that were involved in fighting there. That was about 400 B.C., and they were shown these immense cities down there, and he had no idea who could have made such a thing.
Did he write much about them, Frank?
Very little, but he just mentions how during the campaign, when he was fighting these bandits with the Greek army, they're trying to pacify an area of Turkey. We don't know which one of these cities that he visited. We don't know. But he does mention that when they had they were on leave and the fighting had stopped, and just like soldiers today, they like to tour the area, and there were guides there that showed them this underground city, and he described it in some detail, not too much, but he assumed, he knew that the people there did not make it, that the people in Turkey at that time were not involved. And he assumed that the Phrygians had made it. The Phrygians were an earlier semi-Greek people who did great things, but nothing like that. It would appear that the only, since we don't have much time, I don't want to get into all these arguments for it, but the only people who are the really good candidate for having built this place are people known as the Hittites. And the Hittites are also not as well known as the ancient Greeks or the Romans, but they were a very great people. They were the very first empire builders. They were the first real imperialists. Mm-hmm. Highly civilized people, and they controlled virtually all of Asia Minor. Asia Minor would be all of Turkey and much of Syria and the Near East. They were a superpower, and they flourished for about 800 years. So they were a very great people. They had a capital city called Hattusa, which was right smack dab in the middle of Turkey today. And what's interesting about the city of Hattusa is that we know, and a lot is known about it. I visited the place quite a few years ago, and not much is left. And it creates a very strange impression. Hattusa was a city that had between 50 and 60,000 people. Now, that's interesting because these cities, they also have populations of about 50 to 60,000. So that's the first kind of parallel. The Hittites were also known for building not only great cities, but building excavating subterranean features. They built long tunnels. They're known for having done that. They did underground chambers. So they were the ones that appear to have had the technology. The Hittites flourished from about, well, mostly like around 1,700 B.C., and nobody could touch them. They had the most powerful army. They mastered the use of iron before anybody else. Their chariots were bigger and stronger than anything the Egyptians had. They fought the Egyptians to a standstill, as a matter of fact. And this is when Egypt was at its height. The Battle of Kadesh. The Hittites, the superpower of the Near East, and the Egyptians under Pharaoh, they duked it out. And it was the first time that the Egyptians really met their match. The Egyptians weren't defeated, but they didn't win either. And the same thing for the Hittites.
You know what's funny, Frank, if you think about it, here we are today, thousands of years later, and we're still building deep underground facilities. They call them DUMBs, D-U-M-B.
Right, right.
And we're doing the same thing, but with advanced technology. And yet these people did it with what would appear to be no technology.
Well, I think
we don't know what
technology.
They used. They did something, but we don't know what it is.
I think they did. They must have had an advanced technology of some kind. We don't have a clue what it was.
Well, let's move the rocks. Let's move the big monoliths at Baalbek. How did we do that? All right. So
even today,
correct. Even today, hell yeah,
cannot do it today. But the what's interesting about the Hittites, who is their city, and everything about the Hittites is a really perplexing mystery, because here's this superpower, unrivaled. No enemies could touch them. Their city was a magnificent defensive work, and they were surrounded by the greatest army on earth at that time, at least the equal of Egypt at its height. And yet, in a flash, they went from being top dog to nothing. Their city was blasted to bits. Their city, if you go to it today, there's hardly anything of it left.
We're talking about explosives, dynamite?
The stone, the archaeologists will tell you that when Hattusa, the great capital of the Hittite Empire, was burned, was reduced to a cauldron of flame from one end to the next, the heat was so intense that the stones were carbonized. Hardly ever seen heat like that. There was no one that the Hittites were facing that could have done that. That had to be something other than a military fight. They were opposed, all of the people that they opposed, their enemies, were grossly inferior to what the Hittites had. Yet they, just a flash, they went from being the most powerful nation on earth at that time to nothing. They didn't exist. Something else happened.
Were they all abducted?
No. I think what happened was, we know at that time, geophysicists know, thanks to a conference that was held in 1997. That conference was held on the supposition. I asked one question: why did the Late Bronze Age end so abruptly? Why did it just stop? And the answer for that question from this conference that was held by geophysicists, archaeologists, dendrochronologists, and all kinds of real professionals and experts in their fields was that the Earth experienced a near miss with a very powerful comet. And this was a dirty comet. It had within its tail not just ice, but also small asteroids and sizable meteors. And when this comet, called Comet Encke, made a close pass to the Earth around 1200 BC, it rained down a barrage of meteoric materials that caused terrific damage and burning. And it would appear that Hattusa was right in the path of one or several of these meteoric events. Because I can see nothing else that could have caused such incredible destruction. The Hittites either survive, I'm surmising this, but some Hittites survived this, or else somehow they anticipated this comet coming by, because the comet had made other previous close passes to the Earth, nothing like the one in 1200 BC. And I think that they may have built these cities as a preventative to survive, to get out from under the surface of the Earth and this meteoric event that was taking place. There is definitely, I would say, a connection between what happened in 1200 BC with Comet Encke and with the destruction of Hattusa. I don't see any other possible. It's as though Hattusa was hit with an atomic bomb. And
we do have evidence of radioactivity suggesting nuclear weapons in the ancient past. In India, for example, there's one location that I know
about.
You
bet. There are other locations, and one is in Baghdad. Another one is in the North African desert. So there are long.
That's right.
There
That's
are right. long sections of the Sahara Desert that have been vitrified, that have been turned to glass. There are huge sheets of glass underneath, just underneath the surface of the Sahara. And the only thing that could have caused anything like that is some incredible heat source, some unbelievable heat source. And you find this kind of vitrification in other parts of the world. So I think that it's more than possible. I have come to the only logical conclusion that there was a celestial event of some kind that took place, and we even know the exact year, thanks to the Egyptian records, 1198 BC, right around 1200 BC, but it was in 1198 BC in our month of November. They're another equivalent month. And that's something called the Harris Papyrus, which describes a lot of this that was going on. And that is when, and that's interestingly enough, coincidentally, that's the same year that Hattusa went up in flames from one end to the next. And these cities that were built, I think they were cities of refuge. We're talking about a very great people here, highly creative people, very organized people. And they were able to build a great city like Hattusa, and I think they built the same thing underground. But this is the thing that I mentioned at the beginning of the program. We talk about the Great Pyramid as being a magnificent achievement, and it certainly is. But in a way, it pales before making cities to accommodate 3 million people below the surface of the earth in Turkey.
With flush toilets.
With flush toilets. And a way to illuminate everything without suffocating the inhabitants.
We know the Egyptians had technology that is unidentified. We don't know what it is, but they had help moving those huge, huge rocks from the quarries. They didn't do it with slaves. I don't buy it. Not for a minute.
No. The trouble with slaves is they might be willing workers, but they're not skilled. And when you look at the Egyptian monoliths, the great achievements of ancient Egypt, they could have only been put together by highly skilled labor. We're not dealing here with dumb slaves. The slaves would have been the machinery, and not even the best machinery. No, Egypt was not built with slaves. It was built with highly skilled labor. And nothing else, nothing less than that, would have been responsible for the great things that we see in Egypt. The difference between Egypt, of course, is that the conditions there are so dry that these things have been preserved, at least in ruins anyway, but not the same thing in Turkey. Turkey, this is another thing that just occurred to me. Turkey, as we know, we just found out not too long ago, that Turkey has severe earthquake problems.
Yeah.
It's a very seismically active area of the world, not just coastal Turkey, but all through Turkey. Turkey is an earthquake zone. And yet these underground cities suffered no earthquake damage. They've been buried underground for thousands of years, for more than 3,000 years. And yet there's not a sign of any earthquake damage in any of these underground cities. Dirankuyu, Kalblaki, none of them. So what is what is going on? Yeah. What did they know that we don't know? Mm-hmm. And that they had a science that they were able to apply, which they, and that's why they were great civilizers. But not even their high science could save them from oblivion. That's the scary thing. A great people lasted thousands of years, made magnificent cities, and they're utterly gone. We hardly know. The Hittites were an unknown people until about 1906.
Frank, 3 million.
3 million. Underground. Pretty good. And that one clump of cities alone, over 100,000. Now, if people find all this unbelievable, the only thing I can do is just look up Darren Kuyu and some of these other sites. I do write about them in my book, but that's not the only source at all. Matter of fact,
you could just type in underground cities in Turkey and you'll find them, I'm sure.
And you'll find it. Or you can even go on YouTube and you'll see some terrific tourist videos that are made there. Anybody that gets a chance to go to Turkey these days, I urge them to seek out one of these sites. It's something you'll never forget. It's incredible. So I bring these things up because there's kind of hope for the future in a way, because now we're finding out about what the Hittites did, and we feel pride in our ancestors that they created such magnificent work long before there was the industrial world. And there's a sense of belonging, identification, and pride, really.
And yet, I can't there are no cartouches. There are no frescoes. There are really no drawings explaining any of this.
No.
The one mural you mentioned, that doesn't. That's another issue entirely. So, something's missing from this puzzle, and it's technology. What was it? How did it work? Where did it go? Why aren't there any records of any of this anywhere? Even carved in stone records. Nothing.
Well, there are the Library of Hattusas, the great government library of Hattusas, was found virtually intact. Uh-huh. And the only reason why was because they were written on clay, and this immense fire that came through baked those clay tablets, did not destroy them, just baked them into hard clay. They're like stone, and they preserved these records. And so we do know a lot about the Hittites, but we don't know what happened at the end. They didn't have time to write about that. The only thing
we've got the tablets. We have the stone tablets. We've cracked their language. Yep. We can read them. That's not a problem.
We can read it.
And yet it doesn't describe any of the tech that had to have been there. I mean, your point is very well taken. Illumination, number one. Ventilation, well, we've got the vertical air shafts and all that.
How did they do
the physical work? Men in wheelbarrows? I don't think so.
How did they act? And it appears from what's been excavated that these cities were built at the same time. They're all contemporaneous. Indications are and what's proof of that, one of the basic proofs, is that a great many of them are linked by these tunnels. Imagine that, building a tunnel 200 feet underground that goes for 3 miles. I mean, even today, and you're going to do that without proper ventilation? You're going to do that without proper illumination? No. It makes you wonder. You know, it makes you wonder what's going on. And they're earthquake proof on top of it. Earthquake proof in a place like Turkey, which has major earthquakes all the time.
That was the first thing I thought about. Tens of thousands of people, apparently. You know, claustrophobia, first of all. Who would want to live in darkness like that? Obviously, it wasn't dark.
Unless you are faced with a worse alternative outside.
Maybe they knew that this Enki or another one was coming. Maybe there was an ET issue that they were frightened of, and they dug in. This is really a very interesting puzzle.
It really is. And, you know, you brought up a great point, and that is we have all of these underground military complexes. They are, in effect, cities underground.
Yes.
And here we are, more than 3,000 years later, and we can look back to a time in which somebody else did the same thing. But there must have been some very compelling urgency that forced people.
That's what I think. There was something that's frightened the whole civilization to the extent
something
that
frightened the whole.
They went down, like ours. The reason we went down, same thing. Nuclear weapons.
Why do we build shelters, atomic bomb shelters?
In our underground facilities. You've seen these maps of alleged dumps all over the country.
Yes, of course.
Connected by, you know, extremely high-speed maglev trains.
Mm-hmm.
800 miles an hour, and almost speed of sound, I guess. Some people say more. I don't know. It's all speculative, but there are, obviously.
And they're self-sufficient, too. They don't need anything else once they're down there.
Yeah.
One of these cities, I think it was Darren Kuyu, because that's the one that's been studied the most, had enough supplies on hand. They have done the math on it, so that they really didn't need any outside help for quite a few months. They figure maybe 3 to 5 months they could be self-sufficient.
Hmm.
That's amazing. I mean, in other words, the thing about it is that whether they did or not, we don't know, but the important thing is that they did have that capacity to be self-sufficient underground for at least 3 months. Why would you build a place like that where you'd seal it off from the outside world and you'd have enough to live off for at least 3, maybe 5 months?
Have you been able to read the translations of these tablets at all? The Hittite
tablets? The tablets are mostly bureaucratic things, debts and payments, treaties.
Uh-huh.
There are a few other things that are relate to the humanity of the people.
Well, that was another fascinating Frank Joseph walk through the unknown. I don't know. The idea of no light down there is laughable, and there certainly would be a two-pronged
18 stories
disaster.
Down.
Yeah, it would eat up all the oxygen. It would leave certainly soot all over the ceilings.
And there is none. There's none. There is soot on the first two top levels where the Christians were.
Got it.
When they occupied it afterwards, but the actual original inhabitants, nothing.
God, amazing. Just amazing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that wonderful tour. You're a great tour guide.
Well, you're quite welcome, and maybe if we have time next week, I'll speak a little Hittite to you. You can hear what it sounded like.
Let's
do it. We know what it sounds like.
Okay. All right, Frank. Thank you. You be well. Be safe.
Thank you. You too. It was a great pleasure.
Sure. All right.
Good night.
Night. Frank Joseph, and you can look under his name, and you'll find the book, Ancient Technology. You had to think about that. They had to have light down there. How'd they do it? It's amazing. And they kept animals down there, too. And they had some means of sanitary, mass sanitary system to flush out the waste or flush it away somewhere. That just amazing. Okay, hold on a minute. We'll be right back with hour 2 and 3, 2 hours with David Oates tonight and reverse speech. Lots ahead.